his marriage was arranged. And so he didn't really know his wife when they got married. So guess what? First
man
came marriage.
B.
Then came love. It's just a different concept. We really have a hard time wrapping our minds around that.
Now,
but I only bring that up
did
you
listen
if
to
you
what
remember
he was
last week we talked about the betrothal period. And then the wedding ceremony,
yes,
and then the celebration.
All those things.
And those are foreign concepts to
Pastor
us
David
as well.
Message title.
And I'm not going to rehash
date
all of that tonight,
and,
but I really want to explain to some degree verses 7 and 8 and what
Pastor
that
Davidson
means for us today.
Title.
What does that mean
passage
in the,
date,
or excuse me, what does that mean
and
in light
in
of the millennial reign, and when does this marriage feast come, and how does that all fit together? And I think some very, very good men disagree, but the disagreement is so inconsequential that we're not going to stake a flag and say, thus saith the Lord, because there's some room for interpretation there. But I'm going to give you where I come from and what I've settled on and what I think the Bible teaches. And I'll tell you that I've leaned hard into some different people that I think I would trust. I always never pronounce his first name, but he just passed away last year. Reynolds Showers. Reynolds? How do you say his name? Is it just Reynolds? It has an awkward spelling. It always thinks that it has an extra syllable that it doesn't have in there. So I lean heavy into some of his work. I've looked at Pentecost and come to the conclusion, strap in, I don't necessarily agree with where he's at on some of that stuff. So we're going to go through it. And we're going to go verse by verse in some places and see if you come to the same conclusion. And if not, that's all right. But I think, especially when we say Bible study, it's okay to slow down. It's okay to look up some verses and try to make sense of what God is trying to tell us in his word. And so we looked at the betrothal, the wedding, and the feast last week. But I came across some things that hopefully we'll see together as we go through. Let's look at verses 7 and 8 again in chapter 19, Revelation. It says, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, and fine linen is the righteousness of the saints." The word marriage here used in verse 7 is the Greek word gamos. And it can refer to a marriage or a wedding feast. And just carries with you, you see that in Matthew, in the different parables we talked about last week, John chapter 2. And certainly even you go down to verse 9, you're going to see it again. This is not necessarily the announcement of a marriage, which has already occurred in the rapture when the bride was presented to the bridegroom. I don't even believe it's an announcement of the celebration of the wedding. It's just telling us that it has occurred. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. So I want to give you just a couple of reasons why I think that the marriage supper of the Lamb happens in heaven during the tribulation or the 70th week. Many, many good men would say that it's during the millennial reign, and I was leaning that way just studying it this week and especially spending some time today. I just want to give you just a handful of reasons why I think that this marriage supper is going to be in heaven during the tribulation. Normally, the wedding or the marriage cannot take place at the home of the bride. You can see that in several different parables that we're given. The bride goes and gets his wife. We talked about how that the groom would prepare a place for his bride, oftentimes at the father's house, and would expand the compound. And so the bridegroom fetches the bride, brings her to his house, and makes the bridal chamber ready. It was Christ that indicated that after preparing our living accommodations in heaven, that he would come for us again and receive his bride unto himself, so that his bride could be where he is. That's what we read about in John 14, 2 and 3. In my father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. Christ did not say that he was going to come and join his bride so that he could be where they are, but instead the bride is going to come and be where he is going to be. And so, really, it just harmonizes with the established marriage custom, and certainly Christ's teaching indicate that it's going to be the rapture of the church, and then the marriage of the Lamb will not take place at the second coming of Christ, but instead, as I said, the rapture. Because at his second coming, Christ is not going to return to his Father's house in heaven. Instead, he's going to come to the earth. And so the rapture of the church and the marriage of the Lamb must take place sometime before the second coming of Christ. And the rapture of the church and the marriage supper of the Lamb must be separate events from the second coming. Verse 7 in chapter 19 again says, let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come. Now, when we read that, it looks like a present tense in the English. But again, when you go to the grammar, it carries this idea of a already completed action. So it tells us it cannot be during the millennium because it's going to be before Christ comes back. John is here looking and understanding that Christ has not returned. Christ is not going to return for a couple of more verses, if you want to look at it that way. But he is saying, already this marriage supper has come. It's already happened. It's been accomplished in the point in time. And so, again, then, it cannot be there during the millennial reign if it's already happened before the return of Christ. Thirdly, in Bible times, marriages were a joyful event. I mean, we talk about a celebration, but I want you to think about your own wedding. Now, I wish every photographer would get a picture of the groom right before the bride comes out. They always wait till the bride comes out and get a picture, and his face is beaming. But before that, he's pale, and he's not. It's a joyous time. And you think about your wedding and the time that you got married, you can look back and think of a great day that it was families together and just a friends coming in. It's a great celebration. But I will tell you, when the Lord Jesus Christ comes back, that is not going to be a great celebratory time. That's not going to be a time of happiness and joyfulness. But instead, it's going to be God pouring out his wrath. That is not going to be a time for a celebration of a wedding feast. The marriage custom of the Bible tells us about the festivities that went along, and the camaraderie and the fellowship that were all part of not just the wedding feast, but of the wedding itself. And one author said, the second coming will provide a radically different kind of supper, a funeral supper of dead flesh for the fowl of the earth. And so, the rapture of the church and the marriage supper of the Lamb must take place sometime before the second coming. And there's going to be a separate event with the second coming. So, all right, fourthly, it was customary for the marriage supper to be held at the home of the groom of the parents, and not at the bride. I kind of covered this already. The bridegroom would escort the whole wedding party, now including the bride and the companies, to his father's house for the marriage. And really argues against, I believe, the marriage supper of the Lamb being on the earth. The marriage supper began at the same night that his groom would take the bride, consummate their marriage. According to the Jewish custom that I read, is after the marriage was consummated, the groom would really announce that to the wedding party. Somebody standing outside, and when that was delivered, then basically that person would go to where the feast would be And that would, the announcement would be made that the wedding was complete and the feast would begin. And eventually the bride and the groom would come shortly after that. And so, if this is true, then the marriage supper would begin very soon after the rapture of the church when the bride is presented. And so, as Christ takes his bride, the church, to his Father's house in heaven at the time of the rapture, we will celebrate with God the presentation of the church to Christ. And so, since the millennial is going to be after that, as I mentioned already, then it tells us that we are not going to be in the millennial when we have this feast. You say, what's the big deal? It's not a huge deal, but I think it's important to try to get as best as we can the chronological order of the end of the world as best as we can. If we are in the betrothal now, and then the rapture is going to present Christ's church to the bridegroom, who is Christ, going to be before the millennial reign, the wedding feast then has to be in heaven and before the Lord's second return. But I want to look at one other thing tonight, spend just a few minutes on it, because the Old Testament does speak to some great extent about a feast that I believe is going to be during the millennial reign. And I guess that's why I want to be so specific that the church is not going to be part of that feast in the millennial reign. Our feast is going to be during the tribulation period, but we're going to be up in heaven after that we are gone through the Bema Seat, or the judgment seat of Christ. So I'm going to look at several Old Testament passages and try to help you to understand that I think there are two feasts. There's the marriage supper of the Lamb, what we call, and then there's going to be a marriage feast. Now, I want you to go down just very quickly here to verse 9, I believe it is, in 19. It says, "And he saith unto me, Right blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb." So, who is called to the marriage supper? The bride is generally considered part of the attending party, right? So it must be somebody that is not part of the church. So you'd have Old Testament believers. You would have those that were saved after the rapture. I think there might be one or two other categories of people, but those are the two that are coming to my mind right off. So it would be those that were saved outside of the church age, basically. Because obviously the church is there. The ones I want to focus on just for a brief moment are those believers that were in the Old Testament. They're not part of the church. Don't ever make Israel the church. Don't ever put the church in the Old Testament. You say, wait a second, I know there's a verse in here that calls something somewhere the church. It's just God's special chosen group of people, okay? And it's not talking about the physical, literal bride of Christ in that passage. But I'll tell you that they'll be there for the feast, but they're not part of the bride of Christ. I want you to, we're going to do a lot of turning in the Old Testament. Some of you are going to have to find your index. Those of you with the little tabs on the front are going to be way ahead of everybody else tonight. Okay? We're going to find and look at several of these minor prophet prophecies to help us to see. Now, this is not a minor prophet, but Isaiah chapter 25, verse 6. And I'm going to give you time to find it. Isaiah 25, verse 6, and it says, "And in the mountains shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, wine on the lees well refined." The word for feast here in this verse, verse 6, is the same as that used for wedding feast in Judges chapter 14, verse 10, when it's talking about Samson. So his father went down with the woman, and Samson made there a feast, for so used the young men to do. And then again in Judges chapter 14, verse 12 and 17, it goes right back to talking about that the wedding guest, a wedding feast. And so Isaiah's statement indicates that the wedding guests at this millennial marriage supper for God and Israel will be at all the other people living in the world during that time. So it's talking about a different feast than the marriage supper that we just looked at in Revelation. And so I believe Isaiah was talking about a future time when, after God's worldwide judgment, his people, that is Israel and other nations, are going to feast together in peace. And that's going to be for 1,000. That's going to be part of the millennial reign of Christ. And so this millennial marriage feast really comes from the idea, not only of Isaiah, but the Old Testament, that teaches that God betrothed Israel, or bound himself, bound the nation to himself as a wife. When did he do that? Well, I think that's part of the Mosaic covenant, at Mount Sinai. He was calling the nation of Israel to himself, or maybe you could even go all the way back to the Abrahamic covenant. Jeremiah 2:2 says, "Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I remember thee, the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, when thou wentest after me in the wilderness in a land that was not sown." Ezekiel 16:8 says, "Now when I passed by thee and looked upon thee, behold, thy time was the time of love, and I spread my skirt over thee and covered thy nakedness. Yea, I swear unto thee and entered into a covenant with thee, saith the Lord God, and thou becamest mine." So God had made this covenant with Israel. Why? Why did he do that? And to sit and try to conjure up some other reason or another reason would really be able to, you would be saying, "I know the mind of God on this." And he's never revealed why, other than he chose Israel as his people. But what did Israel do? He did the same thing that you and I do to God on a daily basis. They failed. They broke the covenant. And they repeatedly broke their covenant through spiritual adultery. And by the way, as I just mentioned, before we're too hard on Israel, let's remind ourselves that when we choose to lie, that's spiritual adultery. When we choose to take something that does not belong to us, what we're saying is my self-gratification is more important than me pleasing God. That is spiritual adultery. It's putting something in the place of God in our lives. And so, Ezekiel, in chapter 16, God says, "But as a wife that committed adultery would take strangers instead of her husband." And then, through inspiration of Ezekiel again, in verse 59 of chapter 16, it says, "For thus saith the Lord God, I will even deal with thee as thou hast done, which has despised the oath and breaking the covenant." And we're not going to turn there tonight, but you can go through the book of Hosea, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and at least chapter 9, all talk about spiritual adulteries of Israel. And when you really think about it, wasn't that what God was teaching him when he told Hosea to marry a harlot in the first place? As a representation of what Israel had done to Jerusalem. And so it's not hard for us to understand that God said, "Listen, I'm going to make the nation of Israel my bride." And they said, "I have other lovers." And God said, "Listen, if that's the case, I'm going to write a bill of divorce. You better be careful about how you treat that bill of divorce with God. Because if you think that he ratified that bill, you're going to have some hard times later in 1 Corinthians. You're going to have some difficulties later explaining how that God is still, or excuse me, that the Israelites are still God's chosen people. And maybe we'll take some time, not tonight, but writing a bill of divorcement does not mean that God ever executed that bill. And in a sense, it could be taken as a threat. If you don't, then I'm going to. Isaiah 51 said, thus saith the Lord, where is to build from your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? For which of my creditors is to whom I have sold you? Behold, your iniquities have you sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away. But you'll see, it wasn't permanent. And the reason I don't think he ever executed the bill of divorcement, because by the time you get to Isaiah 54, verses 7 and 8, it says, for a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath, I hid my face from thee for a moment. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. Jeremiah 3:8, again he says, and I saw when all, for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I put her away and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. By the time that's verse 8 of Jeremiah 3, by the time you get to verses 12 through 14, it says, go and proclaim these words towards the north and say, return thou backsliding Israel, saith the Lord, and I will not cause my anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. Only acknowledge thine iniquity, that thou hast transgressed against the Lord thy God, and hast scattered thy ways to the strangers under every green tree. Ye have not obeyed my voice, saith the Lord. Turn, O backsliding children, saith the Lord, for I am married unto you, and I will take you, one of a city, and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. And so he didn't regard that bill of divorcement as being permanent. Let me tell you, when you fill out a bill of divorce, when you executed that, that was a permanent thing. But he withheld that, and he gave his mercy instead of divorcing Israel. And that doesn't mean that God did not judge them. God does judge them, and not only did, but does judge sin. Ezekiel 16:38, and I will judge thee as a woman that breaketh wedlock, and shed blood are judged, and I will give thee blood and fury and jealousy. But guess what happens when God executes his judgment, whether it's on a person or on a nation? What is the purpose of that? Is it just punitive? Is it just so that God can show his great strength and his ability to deal out wrath? No, God can deal out wrath instantaneously. We'd all be dead, and we'd find out in heaven how powerful God is. So God's use of this wrath, or if I could put it this way, this judgment, or you would say when he is chastising us, it is always to bring us back to him. And it's no different with Israel. The whole thing that he was doing to Israel is to bring them back to himself. So through God's judgment, it's going to cause Israel to put away their spiritual adultery. It's going to satisfy his anger, and it will satisfy his jealousy because they turn back to him. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 41 and 42 says, and they shall burn thine houses with fire and execute judgments upon thee in the sight of many women, and I will cause thee to cease from playing the harlot, and thou also shalt give no hire anymore. So will I make my fury toward thee to rest, and my jealousy shall depart from thee, and I will be quiet, and will no more be angry. And so when Israel repents, this is, remember, at a future date, after the second coming, or at the second coming of Christ, Hosea 3:5 says, afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. He's going to mention something very similar to that again in chapter 5. All the way going into chapter 6, verse 1. Chapter 5, 15, all the way to chapter 6, verse 1. I want you to turn your Bibles just for a moment to Zechariah. It's a little bit of a longer passage, but I want you to see it with your eyes and not just try to listen. Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12. All right. reading with me, if you will. I'll read out loud, and you just read with me along with your mind, starting in verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me, whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him, and one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and the wives apart, the family of the house of Nathan apart, and the wives apart. And it goes on and talks about how the wives are going to be separate from their families as well. But what is God saying? He's saying ultimately that he's cleansing the nation. Look at verse 1 of chapter 13 now. In that day, there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. So what does that mean? It means that God is not only going to cleanse the nation, he's going to continue to love this nation. Hosea 14:1-4 says, O Israel, return unto the Lord thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity. Take with you words and turn to the Lord, say to him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously. So will we render the calves of our lips. Asher shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses, neither will we say any more to the work of our hands. Ye are our gods, for in thee the fatherless findeth mercy. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. Not only that, but we're going to recognize Israel as his bride, and that the trouble will be forever. Hosea 2:19-20 says, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. And he's going to reestablish that covenant forever. Isaiah 55:3 says, incline your ear and come unto me here, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Again, in Isaiah 61:8, for I, the Lord, love judgment. I hate robbery for burnt offering, and I will direct their work in truth, and I will make an everlasting covenant with them. Jeremiah 34:40 says, and I will make an everlasting covenant with them that will not turn away from them. I want you to notice common saying of those last three passages that I just read. I will make a covenant. He didn't say, I've made a covenant with Israel. He's talking about a future time. He's talking about a future day that he's going to reaffirm that covenant. Again, in Jeremiah chapter 50, in Ezekiel chapter 16, God continues to say, I'm looking toward a day where not only Israel will be saved, but I am going to reaffirm that which I have promised them. But it's a future day. It's not talking about the Abrahamic covenant. God's going to adorn them, the nation of Israel, as a bride. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord, says Isaiah 61:10. And my soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decketh himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorneth herself with jewels. And so, what is this all leading to? Leading to God reaffirming his covenant with Israel, making Israel his bride as well. You see, they cannot be part of those Jews that are saved, obviously, during this church age, will be part of the bride of Christ that we're a part of. But those that are outside, and those that are saved after the church is taken out, will still be the bride of God. I want to make a distinction. This is a quote that I pulled from an article that Mr. Showers had, but it's a rabbinical view of this Old Testament teaching. So what is it saying? It's just what the rabbis would teach about these passages that we've looked through. It says, but the final renewal of the covenant between God and the people intimated by the prophet was expected by the rabbis in the days of the Messiah. Thus, we often find in view that in these days there will take place the true marriage feast. In this connection, the present age is that of the engagement. The 7 years of Gog will be the period immediately prior to the marriage, and the marriage itself will dawn with the resurrection, and the great marriage feast will be eaten in the future world. So the future marriage of God and the marriage of the Lamb have two different brides. The marriage of God has the nation of Israel as its bride, and the marriage of the Lamb has the church as its bride. So it shows me that it has two different grooms then as well, with God the Father being the groom of the nation of Israel, and Christ being the groom of Christ that is the groom to the church, which is the bride. So that means then that the future marriage of God to Israel presented in the Old Testament as God the Father, not the Messiah, as the groom. That's what I'm trying to say. So you say, what? Why would you spend an entire evening talking about this? Well, because if you start putting the marriage supper of the Lamb in the millennium, you know what happens to a lot of the Old Testament verses then? People start applying those to the church. And what happens then is there can be easily made a confusion about Israel and the church. And if we're not careful, we'll say, well, listen, this belongs to the church, even though it's given to Israel. And so it starts to get a little bit sketchy or shady, if you will, about the distinction that God has clearly given between Israel and the church. Now, we would all say, yeah, I don't think there's anyone here that would come to me and say, Pastor, I see the church in the Old Testament, you know, and Israel, the church is Israel's replacement or some of these other bad theology or bad ideas. But if we're not careful, we're going to take those things that belong to Israel and we're going to give them to church. And so practically or theologically, we're going to say the church is Israel's replacement. We wouldn't say that audibly, but our theology would lead us to believe that if we don't believe that there's two marriage. One is the marriage supper of the Lamb. One is the marriage supper of God to the nation of Israel. And so I think it's important to make that distinction so that we don't make Israel the church or the church Israel. But here's the amazing thing. God is so wonderful that he plans a great reception for his bride shortly after the rapture, after the Bema Seat, but he keeps all of his promises to Israel. And he has that wonderful time of fellowship and rejoicing with all those who have believed in him, even prior to the church age, of the marriage supper. And they are the bride of God. What a great, great God we serve. And I hope that this will at least spark some interest.